Hello, you are listening to The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. Episode 6, Fumbling the Ball. Здравствуйте, товарищи. Hello, comrades. Last time, we went over the February Revolution, the first in a series of events that would lead to the founding of the Soviet Union. Today, we're going to go through not so much a blow-by-blow of events, but the general development of the revolution in broad strokes, from March through basically the end of April 1917, with the formation of the first coalition of the provisional government. There is a lot to go over, so let's dive right in, right after I address the series of bonus supplementals that have accompanied this episode. As we go through the next 74 years of Soviet history, we're going to come across a lot of primary documents which I feel are going to be very important to understanding the Soviet Union as a whole. Speeches, legal documents, constitutions, orders, newspaper articles, letters, really anything that I think is either of historical interest, of historical importance, or both. So as not to distract from the narrative, in the main episodes I will discuss the importance of these various documents. But the texts themselves I will be providing in translation and releasing alongside the mainline episodes. These supplementals won't come out with every single episode, mind you, only when they have bearing on the narrative. But I do encourage you to listen to them if you want the full effect and a deeper understanding of the history we discuss. As I mention at the end of every episode, I provide all the translations myself unless otherwise noted. And the only reason I can think of right now for why I would rely on someone else's translation is if I simply cannot find the original text to translate in the first place. I doubt this will happen, at least not too often, since I'm not going to be pulling up obscure documents from Soviet archives, but rather, these will be relatively well-known texts that probably most of you have at least heard of, if not read yourselves. To be fair, a lot of the documents I'll be translating and reading can be found in various languages online. But I really want this podcast to stand on its own, to be a one-stop shop for socialist Soviet history, so it makes sense to include them here. And besides, I spent years developing my Russian language skills only to land a job that does not require me to use them in any official capacity. So to be honest, it's kind of fun for me to flex that muscle anyway. Today, we've got four, count them, four supplemental documents. Trust me, I did not plan for there to be this many supplementals in one episode. In general, I anticipate there being one, maybe two such supplementals at a time. But particularly with the revolutionary period, things are going to happen really, really fast, and the months of March and April 1917 are some of the most dizzying of the entire year. In the end, the four documents were all short enough, and significant enough, that I figured, what the hell, I might as well include them all. So I hope you enjoy. Okay, with that said, let's get to it. On the 1st of March, before the Tsar had even officially abdicated, the Petrograd Soviet of Workers' and Soldiers' Deputies, which the Russians shortened colloquially to the Petro-Soviet, issued their first decree, Order Number 1. I imagine some, or perhaps even many of you listening, have heard of this order. And if you know anything about it, you know that it allowed for soldiers to elect their own officers, ushering democracy into the ranks. And if you know a second thing about this order, you know that this newfound democracy may have sounded awesome on paper, but was in fact directly responsible for the complete collapse of the imperial czarist, or wait, if there's no czar anymore, whose army are we? Republican? But we haven't declared a republic. Okay, I guess just the generic Russian army will have to do. So, Order Number 1 was, in fact, directly responsible for the complete collapse of the Russian army. Since officers were now elected, this meant soldiers no longer had to follow any orders. This is what happens when the ignorant masses try to take control of their lives. Except, if you listen to this episode's first supplemental, you know that Order Number 1 could not have done those things, because it did not, in fact, allow for the election of officers in the army. That's right, there are no provisions anywhere in the order for the election of army officers. The elections to which the order refers are for representatives to Soviets. As for the whole, we don't have to follow orders anymore, What the proclamation actually said was that, when off duty, soldiers were to be afforded full civil rights as citizens of Russia. Meanwhile, point 6 states explicitly, in the ranks and during the performance of service duties, soldiers must observe the strictest military discipline. So assertions that Order No. 1 led directly to the collapse of the army and military defeat are overblown, right? Well, mostly yes, but there is a kernel of truth to them. First, it was unclear initially if the order was meant to apply only to the Petrograd garrison or to the entire army, which generated a decent amount of confusion outside the capital. Second of all, in some limited cases, officers were being elected by the soldiers themselves, despite, again, this not being a provision of the order. All this prompted Order No. 2, which attempted to assert that Order No. 1 was meant only for the garrison in the capital, and that the officers could not be elected, although those who had been would be allowed to keep their new ranks. But choose your saying. The horses had left the barn at this point, the cat was out of the bag, the genie was out of the bottle. As word of Order No. 1 spread, it did contribute to the trend of collapsing morale. But equally important to note is that these accusations that Order No. 1 caused the army to collapse are made mostly by generals who had been in charge of the army failures under the Tsar. As such, they were trying to malign the entire revolutionary project. The letter of Order No. 1 was, asserting the supremacy of the Soviets over the provisional government in military affairs, although government orders were still valid if they did not contradict Soviet orders, a call for soldiers to participate in the Soviets directly, and protections for soldiers from physical and verbal abuse at the hands of their officers. Even though it is true that the order had some unintended effects and probably could have been worded more clearly, I would posit that if these kinds of changes lead immediately to the collapse of your army likely had much bigger problems to begin with. And as we have seen, the failures of the army and the abysmal morale they engendered preceded and contributed directly to the revolution. It was soldiers unhappy with the continuation of the war and with their officers' treatment of them who played a key and probably decisive role in the overthrow of the Tsarist regime. Many officers across the army went to great lengths to hide news of the revolution, the abdication of the Tsar, and Order No. 1 from the soldiers, including blocking letters and newspapers in and out of the regiments. In many instances, the officers, already despised by the soldiers for cruel enforcement of discipline, particularly as a response to failing morale, preemptively began inflicting corporal punishment on the soldiers under their command. But eventually, the news did reach the common soldier, whether through letters and papers that leaked through the attempted blockade, or through fraternization with German soldiers, who in many instances had heard about the revolution even before the Russians. When soldiers learned that not only had the Tsar been overthrown, not only had Order No. 1 been issued, but their officers had tried to hide these facts from them, they began to extract a measure of revenge. Many of the most hated officers were beaten and executed, many others were arrested, and a handful were left free but had their weapons confiscated. So I guess in a very narrow sense, one could say the order did contribute to soldiers mutinying against their officers, if one ignores that it was the officers' attempts to undermine the order that provoked the mutinies in the first place. The second major document to come out of the period immediately following the February Revolution was the Soviets' Address to the Peoples of the Entire World, which was published in the newspaper Izvestia on the 15th of March. Fun fact, the paper's name in Russian literally translates to English as The News. The address, the second of this episode's supplementals, was an inspirational call for an uprising by the peoples of Europe to end the war. It was specifically not a call for a socialist revolution, only for the peoples to force their governments to end the fighting. The Petrosoviet, as the organ of the Russian people's power, was very clear about what the people wanted. An end to the war, full stop. Ultimately, the address was largely symbolic. I could not confirm this, but I do not believe it was published widely outside of Russia at the time. For obvious reasons, the other powers, allied and central alike, would not want to allow such a rousing call to reach their populations. Even inside Russia, the document was not taken seriously. For all its flowery language about peace without annexations, the authors of this manifesto had no real intentions to end the war. The document, then, was mostly a bone thrown to the masses, who were calling for a very real end to the war. Similar to a campaign promise, all the right things were being said, but given who was saying these things, it would be naive to expect them to follow through. Still, in the end, its significance was twofold. It put in writing the people's unequivocal desire for peace, and it stood in stark contrast to Milyukov's note from a month later, but we'll get there in just a bit. I want now to take a step back from the events unfolding in the aftermath of the February Revolution and talk about an important piece of socialist theory from this period. From the very beginning of World War I, there emerged two diametrically opposed lines of socialist thought about the best approach to the war. On the one side, there was revolutionary defensism, and on the other, revolutionary defeatism. When the German Social Democratic Party, or SPD by its German acronym, voted for war credits to the Kaiser's government in August 1914, it gave birth to the position of revolutionary defensism. I first mentioned this in episode 2 on Lenin, but at the time I did not explain why the SPD voted for the war. The reasoning of the SPD officials, including those who were members of the German government, was that the German proletariat needed to be protected from the encroachment of the foreign bourgeoisies of the nations now at war with Germany. It was the enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of thinking. The German proletariat must side with the German bourgeoisie against the opposing bourgeois armies, lest those armies win and impose even worse conditions on the German proletariat than the German bourgeoisie was already imposing. This kind of thinking became widespread among socialists throughout the war, despite the fact that it was the SPD's adoption of revolutionary defensism that was the immediate trigger for the dissolution of the Second International in the first place. This was due in no small part to the immense authority the SPD wielded as by far the largest socialist party in that body. So naturally, many smaller and less organized socialist parties followed the SPD's lead, and Russian socialists were not immune. On its surface, this thinking makes sense. Our bourgeoisie is only exploiting us, but those bourgeois armies are actually coming at us with guns and will kill us, so we need to stop them, even if it means supporting our bourgeoisie. Our national interests here are aligned, even if temporarily. However, this line of reasoning was incorrect, because it failed to recognize the true international nature of the war. The war put the European proletariat, as a social class on an international scale, in more of an alien versus predator situation. Whoever wins, we lose. That is, no matter who won the war, native or foreign bourgeoisie, the working classes were A, bearing the brunt of the war as the frontline soldiers and suffering at the rear through horrible privation, and B, bound not to come out any better even if their bourgeoisie won the war, because the spoils of the war would not be shared with them. Therefore, the theoretical line which developed in opposition to revolutionary defensism became known as revolutionary defeatism. The proletariat must oppose the war and their own bourgeoisie specifically in order to turn an international imperialist war, which had been provoked by a crisis in capital accumulation, into an international class war, i.e., international revolution. This would be better for the workers in the long run, as it would end the control of the bourgeoisie over their lives, and so was the only way for the proletariat to actually emerge from the war victorious. This line was called defeatism because it advocated for native proletarians to actively undermine the war effort of their bourgeoisies to encourage their defeat in first the capitalist struggle, then the class struggle. Lenin first articulated revolutionary defeatism in 1915 at the Zimmerwald Conference and was, as happened so often at the time, in the minority in his view. Despite this, he stuck to his line in opposition to revolutionary defensism, calling that line opportunistic. Despite the prevalence of defensism in the ranks of the Russian socialists throughout the war, and even in the beginning of the revolution, as we will see, revolutionary defeatism will be coming back to Russia along with Lenin on that train. And in a way, the entirety of the Russian Revolution can be viewed through the lens of the failure of the doctrine of revolutionary defensism in the face of widespread opposition to the war, thereby at least partially vindicating Lenin's defeatism. For a long time after the February Revolution, the Bolsheviks were a minority everywhere in Petrograd, and even across the country, in factories, workshops, soldiers' barracks, and even the Soviets themselves. Initially, the Bolsheviks were disorganized and somewhat rudderless. The Mensheviks and SRs in the Soviet had called for a conciliatory attitude toward the provisional government, saying that the Soviets should support the government insofar as the government does not act against the interests of the proletariat and wider masses of the nation. The Petersburg Committee of the Bolshevik Party supported this line over the objections of many of the rank and file of the party, including the members in the Vyborg district, that most militant workers' district in the capital. And yes, it was the Petersburg Committee, not the Petrograd Committee. The Bolsheviks did not change the name of their citywide committee after the start of the war, just to keep us all on our toes, I guess. Along with the radical declarations of Order No. 1 and the Address to the Peoples of the World, the Petro-Soviet, dominated by Mensheviks and SRs, also called for an end to the general strike in the capital on the 5th of March, despite the openly declared goals of the strike not yet having been met. Recall that these goals included the implementation of an 8-hour workday, pay raises, and an end to inflation. Again, the Vyborg District Committee of the Bolsheviks rejected this call, but the overarching Petersburg Committee supported the Petro-Soviet resolution to end the strike, which angered many in the Vyborg Committee. To add to the organizational knot of the Bolsheviks at this time, between the Petersburg Committee and the Vyborg District Committee, there was the Russian Bureau of the Central Committee. This bureau was composed of the three Bolsheviks we mentioned last time, Shliapnikov, Molotov, and Zalutsky, and was the proxy for the Central Committee that had been elected in 1912. The elected members of the committee, however, were all in exile, and so the three-man bureau was acting on their behalf. The bureau offered critical support for the provisional government, while also claiming the Soviets should be considered the embryo of revolutionary governance for the proletariat, which was obviously a bit of a muddled position to take in the first place. All this is to say, the Bolsheviks were not at all a unified monolith at this early point in the revolution. Nor would they ever be, despite what we are told about the nature of the state they would found. We will see time and again that there were conflicting stances and attitudes at all levels of the party, even during the so-called totalitarian period of Stalin. This confused, contradictory nature of the Bolshevik Party was not resolved once the Bolshevik leaders started returning to the capital, either. As soon as news of the overthrow of the Tsarist regime was received, political prisoners and exiles started preparing for leaving their prisons and exiles and returning to public life. Kamenev and Stalin both returned from Siberia on the 12th of March, and upon their return, they joined a third Bolshevik comrade, Matvey Muranov, as the editors of the party newspaper Pravda, which translates into English as The Truth. The truth, the news, gotta love the bluntness of Russian naming conventions. Now, Kamenev had always been on the right of the party, and yes, there was a right wing of the Bolshevik Party, if you can believe it, and this meant that he was more conciliatory to the Mensheviks and less militantly revolutionary in his attitude and approach to matters. Stalin, for the moment, was influenced by Kamenev, and so Kamenev became the de facto ideological leader of the Bolsheviks. Until Lenin arrived home, anyway. Under Kamenev's influence, Pravda hewed a very conciliatory tone to the provisional government. The paper lent support to the Mensheviks and the executive committee of the Petro-Soviet in their axiomatic call for the need for a bourgeois government as the next step in the development of Russia. Pravda also espoused a revolutionary defensist position, as did Bolshevik committees all over Russia at the time. Again, this is, in hindsight, a very understandable knee-jerk reaction to war, especially as it was being fought on Russian soil. But as Lenin would soon be arguing, it was not necessarily the correct line to take. In trying to articulate the nature of dual power in Russia, Stalin argued that there was a division of labor in the revolution between the Soviets and the government. The former had the role of achieving revolutionary gains. The latter had the role of fortifying those gains. Stalin therefore openly called for support of the government insofar as it worked to fortify the revolution. There was some opposition to this line in some corners of the party, and especially in Petrograd, but it was supported by the majority of Bolsheviks at the time. As for Lenin, well, he wasn't quite back in Russia yet, and this fact was driving him crazy. He pursued his goal of returning to Russia relentlessly and could not stop theorizing about the revolution and trying to provide some, any, direction before he could actually be on the scene. To this end, he wrote 5 letters from afar in March, in which he laid out what he believed were the tasks of the proletariat and the Bolshevik Party in the wake of the revolution, including calling for a workers' state to be formed, the overthrow of the provisional government to be the overarching goal of the Soviets, and an immediate end to the war. As these goals were antagonistic to what Kamenev, Stalin, and the majority of the Bolshevik leadership were calling for at the time, only the first letter was published, and even then, it was heavily edited. You can imagine that Lenin was none too happy with the board of Pravda when he returned home, which he should be doing right about now. If you are enjoying this show, and if you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. As I am just starting out, I do not yet have Patreon-exclusive material. However, if the Patreon page attracts enough attention, that will definitely change. Please also leave a review and rating on whichever podcast platform you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. Now, back to the show. As was mentioned last time, Lenin was in Zurich when the February Revolution occurred. And, as was mentioned just a moment ago, he immediately wanted to return to Russia once he received the news of the revolution. But there was a problem. About 2,500 kilometers, or nearly 1,600 miles, of war-torn Europe stood between him and Petrograd. England and France did not want Lenin to return to Russia, for fear that he would ultimately close the Eastern Front and withdraw Russia from the war. But for the exact same reason, the Germans were completely fine with Lenin returning to Russia. They saw him as a potentially destabilizing element, and hoped Lenin's return would bring about the exact result England and France feared. This presented Lenin with a bold opportunity, which he jumped on. He struck a deal with the German High Command for passage on a train back to Petrograd, leaving Switzerland on the 27th of March, along with Zinoviev and 30 other Bolsheviks, and arriving at Finland Station in the Russian capital on the 3rd of April. And when he got there, his arrival caused nothing short of a political earthquake. The train Lenin traveled on is referred to as sealed, but I'm not quite sure why. I believe, technically, a train is sealed for the purposes of customs. The contents of the train are not recognized by any customs officials in any countries through which the train passes, nor are they legally recognized by the country sending the train. Perhaps in that sense, the train was sealed, and the German government never officially recognized that it had put Lenin and his comrades on a train. But the more colloquial use of the term sealed train obviously implies it was a secret that the Bolsheviks were on it, or that they were kept isolated and locked away from the rest of the passengers. This, however, was not what the trip was actually like. People in Germany and Russia knew Lenin and the other Bolsheviks were on the train, and at various stations and stops, the Russians even got out and walked the platforms, buying newspapers and food and chatting with anyone there. They even spent one night in a hotel in Frankfurt. In any event, Lenin's arrival in Petrograd upended the politics of the revolution. The very first consequence of the deal struck between Lenin and the Germans was the accusation, hurled almost immediately, that Lenin was a German agent, sent to Russia to undermine the revolution. And it was absolutely true that Lenin took money and assistance from the Germans to get back to Russia, and that the German military did benefit from the peace Lenin would ultimately sign with them about a year later. But we have to ask ourselves, who ultimately was using whom here? Lenin had absolutely no love for the German high command, and did not care one whit about the aims of either the German army or the German bourgeoisie. He had a very clear plan, and used the only means available to him at the time to achieve his goal: return to Russia, help the proletariat succeed in its revolutionary struggle, and then turn around and bring that revolution right back to Europe. In this, he and the Bolsheviks very nearly succeeded. So I think the best way to characterize the "Lenin is a German agent" narrative is as one that is false. His immediate short-term goal was shared with the German high command, yes, and so he worked with them. But his ultimate long-term goal was helping the German proletariat rid themselves of that high command, and the bourgeoisie on whose behalf it was acting. Lenin was his own man, and he considered himself acting on behalf of the Russian and eventually international proletariat, not on behalf of Germany. So by definition, he could not have been a German agent. Really, the accusation was a political one, generated by Lenin's political opponents in Russia, in order to discredit him and the Bolshevik Party. It was, unfortunately, very effective at this task. You can still find today politicians and historians hostile to the Bolsheviks and the Soviet Union repeating this claim. But perhaps the most telling evidence that the accusation was nothing more than a political smear is the fact that Lenin's train was not the only one that bore Russian revolutionaries from Western Europe back into Russia. Two other trains with Russian emigre passengers from multiple parties, Mensheviks, SRs, more Bolsheviks, anarchists, Jewish Bundists, and even some non-party affiliated revolutionaries, arrived in Russia over the following weeks. The Menshevik leader, Julius Martov, followed Lenin on the second train from Switzerland to Petrograd, arriving in May 1917. But for some reason, Martov, who, as a Menshevik, supported revolutionary defensism and was much more conciliatory in tone toward the provisional government, was never accused of being a German agent. But enough about that. Upon returning to Russia, Lenin immediately, while still at the station, declared to a crowd of supporters who had come to greet him that the task of the Russian proletariat was to join the workers of Germany and the other warring nations in turning World War I from a capitalist, piratical war for national bourgeois interests into a civil war of the proletariat against the world bourgeoisie. In other words, he began the Herculean task of reorienting the workers toward revolutionary defeatism and away from the defensism of the other socialist parties. He also declared that the task for the proletariat was the overthrow of the government and the reestablishment of Soviet power. Lenin repeated these calls at official party and Soviet meetings that evening and the following day. The reaction from the other socialist leaders on the scene was one of complete shock. Lenin was called a raving madman by the Mensheviks, and even the Bolsheviks seemed confused and embarrassed. Lenin was literally the only political activist in Russia at this moment calling for such a radical program. But this fact did not deter him one bit. The next day, the 4th of April, Lenin presented to a party conference a document officially called On the Tasks of the Proletarian in the Current Revolution, but which would be known more commonly as the April Theses. The theses would be published in Pravda on the 7th of April, and are the third supplemental to this episode. Again, the theses were Lenin's alone. Absolutely no one else signed on to them. Now, it is important to note that the theses, along with the letters from afar he wrote while still in Zurich, were a radical break from positions that Lenin had held in the past. Basically, up to the February Revolution, Lenin had upheld the formula of the so-called old Bolshevism that was similar to what the Mensheviks and SRs were now positing, that after the Tsar, it was the turn of the bourgeoisie to rule, and only after they had fulfilled their historical role of developing the forces of production to new heights would the proletariat come to power. Lenin, however, was now arguing that while this theory and conception of history was still sound, to adhere dogmatically to it, no matter what actual events unfolded, would lead to mistakes and a betrayal of the workers, and therefore a betrayal of the revolution itself. What had caused Lenin to change his approach? What actual event unfolded that led Lenin to completely overhaul his ideas? Lenin's overriding quality as a revolutionary leader was his unswerving adherence to materialist analysis in real time. In the long line of Marxist thinkers, nobody had done it as well as Lenin before him, and hardly anyone has done it as well since him. And his materialist analysis of the revolutionary situation in Russia led him to conclude that the key difference, the unexpected development that theory had not predicted, was the existence of a source of people's power, the Soviets. They had not only formed, but were entrenching themselves across the country as the vehicle for the masses to exercise direct political power. Nobody had predicted they would appear, but to abandon these councils of the people, or to subordinate them to the provisional government, as the Mensheviks and SRs were doing, would be a major step backward and an unforgivable mistake which would doom the revolution and the proletariat. The plan, the expectation, had been to have a period of rule by the bourgeoisie, but surprise, history had given them the possibility of skipping over that phase of development altogether, and so instead of shirking, the workers had a world historical duty to take advantage of their position, and the vanguard party's mission was to explain this reality to the masses and spur them to action. To illustrate this point, I have come up with an analogy. It's not a perfect analogy, and I'm not even sure an analogy is necessary here. But I do think it's a fun analogy, and since I am and forever will be a diehard fan of the Wisconsin football team, the Green Bay Packers, and since it's my show, well, I hope you all enjoy. Imagine the Russian Revolution is like a game of American football. For anyone listening who does not know how the game is played, the rules most relevant here are the following. The way a team wins is by having the highest score at the end of 60 minutes of gameplay. The fastest way to score points is for a team to get touchdowns by having a player on their team get the football into the opponent's end zone, located at either end of a 100-yard field of play. In order to facilitate this goal, a team's offense has 4 attempts to advance the ball at least 10 yards towards the end zone. If they succeed in doing that, they get another 4 attempts to advance at least another 10 yards, thus getting closer and closer to the end zone until hopefully they score a touchdown. If, however, after 4 attempts, the offense has failed to gain at least 10 yards, the other team's offense gets the ball to try for a touchdown in the opposite direction. But crucially, there is no rule that an offense can advance only 10 yards. If at any point an opponent cannot stop you from scoring a touchdown, no matter the distance to be covered to get to the end zone, you are allowed to score. So in the football game that is the Russian Revolution, the Green Bay proletarians are facing off against their hated rivals, the Chicago bourgeoisie. Going into the game, the odds are not in the proletariat's favor, and almost everybody expects the bourgeoisie to win. In fact, the coaching staff of the proletarians, the Mensheviks and the SRs, seem to believe this the most, and so their goal is to just make a good showing. Maybe score some points, but definitely don't score too many. And every time the proletarians advance 10 yards, maybe they should just give the ball back? After all, who are they to defy the odds and actually win? That would upend the playoff picture. Obviously, these coaches suck and should be fired. You shouldn't coach a team if you don't believe you can win. But suddenly, like a ghost from the past, the greatest coach in Green Bay history, the legendary coach Vince Lombardi, Vladimir Lenin, appears out of nowhere to remind everyone that the goal of the game is not to make a good showing, but to win. The proletarians have the ball, they have the momentum, and not only can they win, but they owe it to themselves. If Chicago's defense cannot stop Green Bay, that's their problem, and they don't deserve to win the game, do they? Vladimir Lombardi's theses, despite his ideas being seen as crackpot and his speeches as embarrassing by the other socialist leaders, including, for example, his comrade Kamenev, actually resonated with the people who mattered the most, the rank-and-file members of the Bolsheviks. So much so that, by the end of April, Lenin had managed to win a majority of the party to his position, and had reoriented the Bolsheviks away from reconciliation and opportunism and back on the path of true revolution, the seizure of state power by the proletariat. It was at this point that Stalin went over to Lenin's camp, which certainly helped bolster Lenin's position. But even more so, he gained support because his arguments resonated deeply with the needs, thoughts, and goals of the rank and file. Lenin was not manipulating the workers who made up the party. Rather, he was a keen, insightful, and effective leader. He understood what they wanted, and he spoke to that. Lenin never swerved from his belief that the vanguard party must be a tool for the workers to achieve their own emancipation, and not a group of dogmatic leaders collaborating with the bourgeoisie. If the party ever turned into that, it would never be able to fulfill its true purpose. But to be fair, Lenin's victory in what Trotsky terms the rearming of the party got a pretty major assist. The Chicago bourgeoisie, never really able to stay out of its own way, fumbled the ball pretty badly, and like any good coach, Lenin was able to capitalize on it. Okay, I promise, that's the end of the analogy. First, we need to check in with the Russian army. Trotsky reports in his History of the Russian Revolution that the general mood in the army was tense. Since learning of the Tsar's abdication, the rank-and-file soldiers had taken a defensive posture on the front. They made it be known to the Germans that they would defend against and repel any attacks by enemy troops, but by the same token, they would not go on the offensive themselves. The message was, "You don't mess with us, and we won't mess with you." The Germans, for their part, welcomed the lull in fighting on their eastern front so they could focus on other theaters of the war. So a kind of de facto truce had settled in between the two armies. Given this new state of affairs, Russian soldiers came to expect a quick and decisive end to the war. They believed that the government would negotiate for peace and withdraw Russia from the conflict, and that they would all be going home soon enough. Of course, this did not stop morale from plummeting, which it continued to do through March and April, with many soldiers simply deserting their posts and setting out on foot for home. Meanwhile, workers across the country, especially in Petrograd, had also come to expect an end to the war, if not right now, then very, very soon. But in the middle of April, the provisional government committed its first major blunder of the revolution. Given the rousing declaration for peace the Petro-Soviet issued in the middle of March, and this general atmosphere of waiting expectantly for peace, what do you think would happen if the government, composed of landowners, industrial bosses, and nobility, were caught promising their allies in the war that they had nothing to fear, that Russia would not be abandoning its obligations to them anytime soon, and in fact intended to fight the war to a decisive, victorious conclusion? Let's find out. On the 18th of April, Minister of Foreign Affairs Pavel Miliukov sent via telegram his now-famous eponymous note to Russia's allies in the war, in which he promised not only to not withdraw Russia from the war, but to continue fighting until a, quote, lasting peace could be obtained. The text of this note comprises the fourth and final supplemental for this episode, and it became public when it was reprinted in newspapers on the 20th. As you can imagine, it went over like a lead balloon, sparking what came to be known as the April Days, or the April Crisis. Condemnation of the note was widespread, swift, and furious in the entirety of the socialist press. Starting the 20th, there were demonstrations in Petrograd, Moscow, and other cities against Miliukov's war to a decisive victory. Clashes ensued, and people were killed on both sides of the divide, pro- and anti-government. In the end, the first coalition government was formed, with broad support from the masses. It was a coalition because up to then, the provisional government had been made up only of holdovers from the Duma. But now, the government and its ministries would include members of the Petro-Soviet who had not been part of the Duma. Milyukov and the arch-conservative Guchkov resigned, and the Petrosoviet voted to allow some of its members to participate in the government. Remember, the SR Alexander Kerensky was already a member of the provisional government, and the thought among the workers and soldiers in Petrograd was that by assigning even more socialists to the government would be pulled to the left. Among the new socialist ministers were Irakli Tsereteli, a Georgian Menshevik, as Minister of Post and Telegraph, Matvei Skobalev, another Menshevik, as Minister of Labor, and Viktor Chernov, an SR, as Minister of Agriculture. On the whole, the provisional government went from being dominated by the cadets, with support from a handful of other very small political parties I won't even bother you about, to being a roughly even split between the cadets, the SRs, and the Mensheviks. Crucially, super-duper crucially, the Bolsheviks refused to take up any posts in the coalition. This meant that as time went on and the provisional government lost more and more credibility, the Bolsheviks remained the only party untainted by affiliation with the government, and indeed came to be seen by all sectors of the masses, workers, peasants, and soldiers, as their best chance of doing away with the official government. But that's just the story of the socialist leadership during the April days. Before we wrap this up, we need to discuss the disconnect between that leadership and the socialist rank and file. While there were street battles and a general fury at the news of Milyukov's note on the part of the workers and soldiers, many socialist leaders, including Lenin, came out against the demonstrations. Lenin argued that the calls for the overthrow of the government were premature, that the working class as a whole across the nation was not yet sufficiently united to seize power. Therefore, Lenin derided calls to overthrow the government as adventurism and insisted they were doomed. The Bolshevik leader even drafted a resolution, which the Petrosoviet adopted on the 21st of April, forbidding party members from participating in the demonstrations. But again, the calls for restraint went unheeded by many, which demonstrated the lack of discipline among the rank and file of all the parties, not just the Bolsheviks. Now, I know what some of you are thinking. Wait a minute, weren't you just saying a minute ago that Lenin wanted to win the game of the revolution? Now he's telling everyone they need to cool their jets? What gives? Fair question. But as we will see a few more times over the next several months of the revolution, Lenin was acutely aware that winning could not be achieved in just one place at one time. In any country, but especially one as vast and diverse as Russia, for a socialist revolution to succeed, it was necessary for the bulk of the working class across the entire nation to be working in unison at the same time. Winning in the capital would be a temporary victory that would likely be doomed to the same fate of the Paris Commune, which would then set the entire movement back years, maybe decades. So although it may seem counterintuitive, Lenin, by recognizing that the bulk of the proletariat was not yet with the Bolsheviks, called for restraint, thereby still serving the ultimate goal of a successful workers' revolution. Lenin's approach at this point was instead a policy of patiently explaining to the workers that the government was bourgeois and that as such it was not the guarantor of the revolution, but instead a threat to it. And on top of this, the other socialist parties had succumbed to opportunism by joining forces with the bourgeoisie. Lenin and the Bolsheviks proclaimed everywhere that the workers would not be able to achieve their goals or defend their revolution by working with the bourgeoisie, but only by defeating them in a direct head-to-head confrontation. It was a message that, as more time went on, worked exactly as intended and led to explosive growth in the party's ranks. And next time, we're going to explore in more detail just that. What the impact of the Bolsheviks' messaging was on Russian society. We will also take stock of how that society is faring post-Tsar, and what they are learning about the nature of the provisional government and the SR and Menshevik parties. Marxist-Leninists understand the October Revolution, which is coming to us sooner than you might think, as a powerful fusion between the vanguard party and the Russian population. But that fusion did not occur overnight. It was a months-long process, often painful, of trial and error on the part of the Bolsheviks and lived experience on the part of the Russian masses that taught them whom they could trust and whom they could not. So next time, we will discuss in more detail how the two revolutionary forces of the Russian people and the Vanguard Party start on their path to their mutual date with destiny. Thank you so much for listening. All translations from the Russian text are provided by me, unless otherwise noted. Any errors or inaccuracies are therefore my own. If you are enjoying this show, and if you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. Any amount helps and is greatly appreciated. This entire project is run only by me in my spare time, and in practicing my anti-capitalist values, I will never run ads. So regular contributions allow me to devote more time, energy, and resources to making the show the best it can be. Please also leave a review and rating on whichever podcast platform you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. If you'd like to get in touch, you can write me at sovietpod@gmail.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. До свидания.